Hello, and welcome to the Global Film Podcast, a weekly discussion of all things cinema. I'm your host, Diego Andaluz, and today I'm happy to be joined by Kevin Lee, writer for Film Inquiry and That Shelf.
Hello.
David Cuevas, festival editor at Film Hounds Magazine.
Howdy.
And Allison M., writer for Filmotomy.
Hello.
So on today's episode, we have a very special discussion coming up, which is going to be an entire recap of the South by Southwest Film Festival. Now, this is, again, a film festival normally takes place in Austin, Texas, but for coronavirus reasons, it's obviously taking place virtually. So we all had a chance to watch it, despite being spread out all over the entire country. And we're going to delve right into quick discussions of every single film we saw. So let's get started with Language Lessons first. What were your guys' thoughts on that one?
I enjoyed it overall. It's a very sweet little slice of life, mumblecore. Somebody compared it to Zoomcore. I guess that's a thing now, which is... I'm fine with it, honestly.
Yeah, I actually think it's probably my favorite one from the festival. It was like exactly the movie I needed. With all the noise going on and happening in the real world and all that, Language Lessons was like a hug for me. Like really, it was just a nice, simple, sweet and endearing and really kind story about two people who really don't know each other and they form this friendship. And I really just love the message that it's saying. You don't have to completely know a person. There's many things you might not know about them, but you can care for them just as much. I think that's a very good message to say right now.
Yeah, honestly, I think that it also, like, the way it uses its filmmaking, it's very clever because it does a lot of stuff that some of the Zoom movies I've seen in the past 6 months have not been able to do. Like, for instance, I'd compare it to Lockdown because they both use Zoom in a way and they try to depict its awkwardness at certain points. But for Lockdown, it just kind of plays as awkward and as if you're not in on the joke. But here, it actually works quite well and it uses its awkwardness for comedy and also for some emotional beats as well. So I appreciated that side of it. I also found the writing to be pretty clever. There were a couple of twists and turns there that I was not expecting. And even though when I was going in, I thought it was going to be just like a simple, straightforward comedy about using Zoom to connect, it developed into something that was like so much deeper and with greater themes. I really appreciated that because in a time like this where we're all feeling isolated, where we're all feeling disconnected, films like this show us that connection can be formed despite these circumstances. And even though I believe in the film, it's not supposed to be like, oh, there's COVID going on. It's just the fact that it's a Spanish lesson that's happening in Central America while Mark Lucas's character is all the way in Oakland and Natalie Morales's character is in Costa Rica. And they're able to connect and bond in a way that just seems like the only way that we can connect and bond these days. And to see it turn into such a happy ending, despite some pretty sad beats that I think do work for the film, the fact that it ends on an uplifting high note really made the film for me. And I think it definitely stood out in terms of a bunch of other films. Well, it might have just been the films that I watched this festival, but I normally stuck to darker films because that's more my jam. But for the few uplifting films that I saw, I'd say this is definitely the one that stood out for me the most. So now let's move on to Sound of Violence. Allison, give us your thoughts on that one.
Okay. I hate to say it because I do sound mixing too. And I noticed that the sound was like really, really poor in the beginning. I hate to be negative. Overall, like it had some really cool moments, but quality dampened the overall effect of it. But I did think the main actress, Jasmine Savoy Brown, was pretty good. And there was a cop at the end that was pretty good. But otherwise, the acting also left a little to be desired. There were some kind of interesting moments, but I just thought overall it was just okay. How about you?
I'd say I'm quite more mixed on it in terms of extremes. Now, I really appreciated kind of the visual style of it. It was very dynamic. Again, it revolves around someone who was deaf, and now she kind of uses sound, I'd say, for pleasure a bit. Like she has these sensations when she hears extreme sounds that kind of just light up the screen. And that aspect of it, I really appreciate it. I think it builds tension well. Again, the cinematography, the color palette is just, it blew me away. However, I think it relies a little bit too much on just brutal gore. I think it was a little bit too much for me how deeply it relied on that, because it basically every single part of the film eventually would turn into just something like gory and gore. And it's kind of basically, I felt as if it was just a very repetitive plotline of, she talks to someone, she meets someone, she collaborates, she wants to collaborate with them, and then she kills them in a very gory way for her music. And that kind of goes on and again and again and again. And it gets a little bit redundant for me, I'd say. I wouldn't necessarily say bored, because it was definitely very visually dynamic, but it felt a little bit too redundant to fully work for me. And the ending, I felt as if, once again, it was just very redundant. I think the execution from a technical standpoint was brilliant, but from a narrative standpoint, it was quite poor. And this, I think, could have functioned as a brilliant short film. I could definitely see this one going on to win many awards. I'm getting lots of buzz for the team behind it. But I think it was just the concept was a little bit too redundant and underdeveloped for this one to fully work for me. So now let's move on to the spine of the night. This one was a pretty intriguing one. I know it's gotten a little bit of a divided reception, so I'm excited to hear all of your guys' thoughts. Whoever wants to go, just go ahead.
I'll start first, I guess. The spine of the night reminded me a lot of this animated film from 2016 called Nova Seed, another kind of hard fantasy world-building piece that utilized rotoscoping to kind of create like this new futuristic atmosphere. I think both films are very well-intentioned in what they're trying to set up, but I feel like they're almost a little bit too self-serious in their own sort of engrossing world building to the point where it just feels like you're watching a bunch of animators play D&D. It also really doesn't help when the animation medium sort of, like, the point of animation, at least for me, is for it to have some sort of metatextual context, for the animation to be integral to the storytelling and to justify the medium as it is. I think we can look at other works like This Magnificent Cake, where the stop motion animation specifically complements the narrative and, in fact, enhances some of the narrative plot points in the film. In the case of The Spine of the Night, I don't think the rotoscoping really helped the film in any particularly engrossing manner. And that really detracted from the general impact of the world building and even the fantasy elements that are presented throughout the film.
Allison, would you like to go?
Sure. I mean, this is not my type of film, but it reminded me of the 80s, like the Skeletor. You know, that's just my basic reference. Someone told me about Rotoscope, and I thought that sounded very cool, but also really time consuming. And it did seem like this was marketed more toward men. And like I said, this is not my type of thing. I'm sure some women would like that. There was the Swamp Witch, and I kind of wasn't digging her character. I mean, it was okay, but there were books to be burned. They were talking about, you know, there was an order to protect the knowledge of man, and that sort of thing just doesn't resonate with me. So I was just kind of like, on that one.
Yeah, I completely understand that. Yeah, The Spine of Night is a very interesting movie for me. It reminds me of other adult animation like Heavy Metal, which clearly inspired this, like other works from the 80s. I found this movie to be, at least in the first half, really difficult to follow because I felt like the film made no effort to really hold your hand in creating some sort of narrative or creating some sort of internal logic in the world that the characters were living in. I couldn't get a grasp of the rules and where people are geographically and what is it exactly that everyone wants. And slowly, as the film progresses, I slowly started to get more and more understanding of exactly what this movie is actually trying to do. It gets to a part that involves this character voiced by Richard E. Grant that I realized this movie is really more than just a fantasy. It's really trying to cross boundaries of genres. It's not completely a fantasy. It's really also very much like a cosmic horror that you would find in something from H.P. Lovecraft or something like that. And I realized that the movie really is more about tone and vibe and atmosphere. And I did find myself enjoying more of the second half of the film. I really started to get on its wavelength. And I realized, yeah, this is actually quite interesting. It's a bit much to ask. Like I said, in the first half, it's like being part of a club that you were not invited to in the beginning, or like being in a club and you just don't understand the stuff that they're talking about. But I do think there is an interesting idea to be had here with the whole concept of the bloom being a source of power and knowledge and magic. And yeah, I did find it fascinating. It's worth a watch. I do hope the writers and directors perhaps try this again and tell a new story. And I actually think this is a, this could make an interesting live action movie, but I doubt any studio would actually green light that.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree in that the rotoscoping might have taken a little bit of the power away from it, but it was obvious that I think it was done more for budgeting reasons over anything else. Like, I'm sure if they had the chance to do this live action, they would jump at it. But it's clear that a film of this size would take a lot of money and effort. That I don't know if it's their first feature or something, but it's definitely like an indie, smaller scale feature. So they definitely had to scale it down in some sense of it. And I'm sure like they... rotoscoping can be a cool effect, but I did find it to be kind of on the cheaper side of rotoscoping. Like I've seen things like Undone, for instance. Undone, I think they use the same technique. It looks beautiful. And this one, I guess that was the intent, but it looks more like a crudely drawn cartoon. And I'm not quite sure how I feel about that. But if that's what it was going for, then it definitely achieved that. Overall, though, I think the film is a little bit too overstuffed and too ambitious, kind of in the wrong way. As you guys were saying, it was devoid of any context to kind of explain what was going on, and you were left there trying to figure out what was happening yourself. There's a film that I think premiered at Sundance that I'm sure you guys all watched or heard of called Crypto Zoo, where it does kind of take the same psychedelic wild approach where it just kind of throws everything at the wall, sees what sticks, and it's just a wild ride. But even that film had some semblance of an actual structure and plot beats and character arcs, even though it was super wild. And also the visuals were, I think, much more eye-popping. Like, they definitely grabbed your attention much more than this one. And so I think all that did help that one succeed for me. But this one just felt a little bit too overstuffed. Like, if it was doing way too much without explaining the motives behind it. And I tolerated it. And it's definitely going to find its cult audience. I would not be surprised if this one becomes a cult classic. But overall, I think this one was just not necessarily for me. Now, let's move on to Witch Hunt. Now, I was the only one here who saw it, but it was, I'd say, a smart metaphor for kind of what's been going on today with Border Patrol and immigration. And I think it does even call back a little bit to certain parts of the whole Holocaust. And I think it relies a lot on its metaphor, and now its metaphor is very, very smart, so it's not like as if that's a negative per se, but the way that it frames its narrative is very clever, and I appreciated that. Now, some of the logic behind it was a little bit warped, I'd say. I think they could have done a better job explaining exactly what was the reason behind the persecution and like what were the overall consequences and what kind of started this persecution, because it's not very well explained if this has been something that's been going on for a while now, if this is kind of a new phenomenon. And I think definitely considering how timely it tries to be, it would have benefited from a little bit more context, kind of just to show what exactly is going on. But overall, it's a very smart film. It does rely a lot on this one metaphor, and it does beat it to death, but it does so in a very taut and effective manner. So this one was a win for me. Now let's move on to The Feast, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. Let's start with David.
So The Feast, a very interesting film sponsored by the BFI. And honestly, I liked what it was going for. Although part of me kind of wishes this was just a mid-length or even short film feature, because a lot of the slow, grueling pace, which is effective in parts, mind you, it doesn't necessarily really come together, and oftentimes it feels like it's padded out by needless filler. I think there's a lot of good ideas in this. I kind of like the eco-horror-centric narrative that's presented, that's kind of like a... what you would call a quote-unquote eat the rich narrative, but not really through and through the whole entire film. But overall, outside of some really neat visuals, some good concepts, at least, that kind of ground the piece, I thought this was a little bit of a drag.
Yeah, I can see your point. Now, I loved this one, but it was mainly because of its wild and absolutely bonkers third act that was completely up my alley. But I'd say the first second act, for sure, it felt, I'd say, maybe like a dragged out version of the first 5 minutes of Funny Games, which is just all this build up. And it's a little bit like you're not quite sure what's going on, but after a while that kind of magic and mystery kind of wears off and you're just left wondering, well, so what's gonna happen next? I do feel that this could have worked, maybe not necessarily as a short, but as a much shorter feature. Like, if this was, I believe it was like an hour and a half. If this was like maybe an hour, a little bit more than an hour, it may not qualify as like a full feature per se, but I think it would have worked much better with its pacing. It was just, there was too much buildup for the ending. But the thing is, the thing that won me over was the absolute insanity of the ending. Just so many things happen at once. And I actually had to rewatch it just to kind of fully grasp what was going on. And even then, I'm not quite sure if I understood what actually was going on plot-wise. Like, yeah, I got its message. But in terms of what was actually happening to go from A to B, I was actually left a little bit confused. But that is something that I like. That's something that I appreciate. So overall, I absolutely loved it. It definitely could have worked better with maybe a more taut second and first acts, maybe even taking them out, I'd say, or definitely shortening them down and maybe adding some more dynamic elements to them that were seen in the third act, adding them earlier to kind of give a little bit more intrigue to what is going on.
I agree with you a lot about like the ambiguity and the mystery. I think that's what kind of makes the feast really fun. And part of it is sort of like we can interpret that the main character, I forgot her name, but the maid, quote unquote, is almost like a force of Mother Nature, almost taking vengeance against sort of like this property damage on the farm. And I think that really works almost as a gentrification metaphor. There's a little bit of a resemblance of a bit of a potent horror allegory in the feast. And that's what makes it kind of really fun, especially the ending where it goes kind of all berserk and it's a huge bloodbath and there's maggots and oh boy, that was intense.
Yeah, Severed Foots too. That one is quite the wild one. So anyways, let's move on now to Gaia. I know, David, you saw half of this one. So do you just want to get started on maybe why you quit or what ended up happening there?
So I actually was kind of digging it. I liked the aspect ratio change. I liked the visuals. I liked some of it. I was like almost, it was sort of like middle of the road, basically. And the reason why I quit midway through was for two reasons. I was really tired. And I was like, I'd much rather give this movie a fair shot later. And then I realized this was recently picked up for distribution by Decal, which is the Neon Bleecker Street Company. And they said that they were going to release this film in summer. So I was like, screw it. If I actually want to give this movie like my full attention, I just wait until summer of 2021 and then actually give it a fair shot then.
Nice, nice. Did anyone else watch this one or just me and David?
Oh, yeah. I saw it, too. I agree. It was, like, really late. It was the last film of the day, and I wasn't digging it, per se. I mean, I thought it was all right. The girl, Gabby, played by Monique Rockman, was pretty good. A lot of it just seemed allegorical, although it was a good metaphor for COVID as well. The production was shut down 1 week into filming, so they really had to get rid of most of the crew. So I think it works. It's a really intimate film. They made it happen. But, you know, a lot of it was just this fungal thing growing out of, you know, people's mouths, eyes, and other places in the body. And then, you know, when they ripped off the mushrooms or whatever, then it was like, ugh. It was, I don't want to say it was disgusting. It was just not my type of film per se, but there were a lot of like dream sequences. So a lot of what was happening, you didn't know. Well, you knew it wasn't real. But anyway, on one hand, I liked the dream sequences, but they kind of overdid it. And then at the end, I don't know if this is a spoiler. I mentioned this in my review. It's like the older guy, Berend, he's willing to sacrifice his son, like Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son, Isaac. So it kind of like took a different spin than the Abraham story. But overall, it didn't seem like a very fluid story from like point A to B to point C. It just seemed like random stuff happened for the visuals. So I don't know. Although it did have a solid ending.
Gaia personally blew me away. I think it definitely thrives in its spirituality. And I think Jacob Bauer, I believe is how you pronounce his last name, just best direction of the entire festival. He delivers an atmospheric masterclass, and he just channels so many different directors and influences that, again, I don't know if they were intentional or not, but I felt as if it just, they were perfect mirrors of that. And he kind of brought them all together to create something that I haven't seen before. You have Uncle Boonmi in here. You have Hereditary, like the atmosphere of Hereditary. Even though it's not necessarily a family drama like that, you can very much feel an Aster-like build going on throughout the entire film. You got Annihilation with the eco-horror, of course. And In the Earth, I'd definitely say, obviously, those kind of films were made around the same time. So I wouldn't say necessarily maybe they drew from each other. But a lot of similarities with that too. The grimy parts of it, I absolutely love. The dream sequences, again, I absolutely love it. Once again, it's some, a film that throws everything it has at the wall. But Bauer here, and I think this is what it shows him, again, he has an incredible talent. He's able to bring it all together in a coherent way that stays ambiguous, but it's not something that like you're totally lost in. And again, it might have also benefited from, this was once again the last film I watched of that night. So I was already a little bit of in a tired kind of elevated state. And I think that did aid in my viewing of the film. I had no distractions. The entire house was dark. And I could just focus on the entire film from start to finish. And honestly, it might be my favorite film of the year. Again, it draws on so many of the art house horror influences that I hold near and dear to my heart. And I really hope this becomes a hit. Again, I'm not sure if there's going to be much mainstream appeal to this one, but depending how Decal releases it, because I don't know if it's just a home release or because I know Decal is like the home release distributor for Neon and Bleecker Street. I don't know if they're going to go the theatrical route, maybe a limited release and then go move it on to Blu-ray, DVD, whatever. But I really hope that the art house horror crowd finds this one because I think they are going to absolutely love it. And now, why don't we move on to Violet? So I would love to hear your guys' thoughts on that one as well.
So I think I was drawn to it because of the subject matter. Violet's working in the film industry as a development executive. And, you know, it's kind of weird. She has the voice in her head telling her she's not good enough. And it's literally Justin Theroux's voice. And then there are these handwritten thoughts that are kind of like the angel on her shoulder, like saying, yes, she is good enough. And overall, I kind of see what it was going for. It kind of fell flat in a few areas for me. But overall, the writing was really poignant and it really went in a great direction. Yeah.
So yeah, personally, Violet, I felt it was a strikingly bold and fiery exploration of kind of one's own self-doubt. And I actually didn't know much about this film going in apart from the fact that it starred Olivia Munn. And I've liked some of her previous work, so I decided to give it a watch. And I was surprised by the Justine Bateman stylistic flair in this, as well as Olivia Munn's powerhouse performance. Two things that I wasn't expecting, honestly, but I'm glad that happened. I wouldn't say that this film is subtle at all. That's the one thing that I think I'm a little bit conflicted on, but I think that's what it was trying to go for. It has absolutely no subtlety. Again, her thoughts, her inner thoughts are just seen blatantly on screen with this kind of white cursive text, which again adds to the stylistic flair. But you're left with absolutely no subtlety. And again, most of the time your actors have to actually like kind of display maybe the character's inner thoughts. And here, that doesn't need to be done, but that does give room to Olivia Munn to kind of add some other layers to her performance and focus on those aspects of it. So I think I enjoyed that part of it, but I'm still a little bit conflicted. There were some parts at the beginning, I'm sure you know, Allison, where when things would kind of get tense and tenser and tenser, it would kind of fade into this red. And I appreciated that flair to it. I don't think that built up into anything. So I'm a little bit disappointed by how it ended up ending in such kind of not necessarily low, but just an anticlimactic note. I think if it ended a little bit more dynamic to kind of mirror the start, that would have helped a lot. But I think for what it was trying to go for in terms of kind of Olivia Munn's character kind of getting rid of that self-doubt and really finding herself eventually, again, no spoilers, but cutting off people that she doesn't feel aid her in what she's trying to do, having to balance her passion and her career and kind of just weigh the pros and cons of that. And then eventually finding a semi-happy ending, I'd say. It was a good arc. Justine Bateman's employment of these dynamic storytelling devices is definitely going to result in an unforgettable experience for all. So overall, I thought it to be one of the better films of the festival, but that's just my opinion there. So now I do want to move into one that I believe we have all seen, which is Here Before. I've heard a lot of mixed things on this one. I really appreciated it, but let's hear what you guys think.
Yeah, I'm mixed to positive on the movie. Without a doubt, Andrea Riseborough she can carry an entire movie. Like, she can carry every movie on her shoulders. She gives fantastic performance in this. There's also quite a bit of direction and cinematography, score, and some really interesting song choices too that definitely caught my attention, creeped me out a bit as well, where I was like, oh, what is going on? The movie does take a while to get going. And It's part psychological thriller, part mystery, and I actually really enjoyed the build-up. Second act of the film is quite interesting, and when it actually finally builds to its answers, when it finally reveals what is actually happening, I found all of that in the third act rushed. I think on paper, I don't mind the actual story beats and where the story actually goes, where the turns are, what the twists are, and what the reveals are. I don't mind them. I think they are told too quickly, though. That being said, I think the performances are great, and I think there's a lot of signs of a really good director here. And so I think this is one of those low-budget thrillers that don't entirely work for me, but I do give it a pass because there are some quite a bit of interesting stuff going on.
I agree a lot with what Kevin said. I think it's a very ambitious film. I think it's also incredibly well directed and even blocked in moments. But at least for me personally, I was not a fan of the end reveal. At least for me, it felt more like a cop-out. It felt more like a cop-out instead of actually exploring a little bit more deeper on its themes of the withdrawing of the truth when it comes to relieving from trauma. The whole entire purpose of the film is mainly to dedicate sort of the reveals and psychological identity, at least, of a person going through like these cycles once more, but then actually finding out some new things about their family, what happened on that fatal car ride that happened so many years ago. She didn't know that the father was singing. What else happened during that moment? And it almost like becomes a psychological breakdown in that moment. And at least for me, I think this would have worked better if there wasn't a clear resolution, if it just ended at one particular scene where the little girl is just walking down sort of like not this alleyway but sort of like this garden and just cut to black and it just ended there, so that we don't have an exact resolution, but at least we know the purpose of the film and what specifically director Stacey Gregg wanted to say with this film. I think Andrea Riseborough is a fantastic actress, and she knocks it out of the park again once more in Here Before. But as for everything else, I was not too big on it. I think it's very well intentioned, but not necessarily my cup of tea.
I think it works pretty well with the creepiness factor, because the children say like a lot of creepy and disturbing things. And I wasn't 100% satisfied with the ending, but I do feel that the resolution was satisfactory. And yeah, it is sort of Andrea Riseborough's character sort of like has a struggle, like, is she crazy? And that is kind of the crux of the film. That is like, yeah, her performance is the main thing. But yeah, the children that just say the creepiest things, I was just like saying aloud throughout the whole movie, oh my God, you know? So yeah, overall, it was a little better than just okay, but, I guess what was lacking is, it's hard to say, just, it just felt a little too weird at times. It's not going to be maybe a classic like The Sixth Sense, but it just had that creepiness factor.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely get what you guys are all saying. Like, let me just preface this by saying that I think Stacey Gregg is definitely going places. I think this is a very simple story in certain parts, and even though those simple parts may drag it down, I think that her methodically tense direction with it, she's able to create a palpable atmosphere throughout the entire film. So even in those parts where maybe the story isn't quite clicking for one, I was still pretty captivated just by the angles that she uses, the slow zooms, the kind of off-kilter cinematography that she instituted in some places. And I think that does turn the film into a brilliantly calculated psychological thriller. The ending, I feel that in towards the second act, beginning of third act, it was kind of teasing this supernatural angle that I think I would have preferred maybe if they had delved deeper into that one. It definitely would have resulted in a tonal shift, but I think that she could have definitely pulled it off and created something that maybe stood out a bit more. So I would say in that sense, the actual ending may have been a tad bit disappointing, But overall, I think at the end of the day, this is a film more about the journey that gets her to that ending rather than the ending itself. Because again, I do feel the ending was a little bit rushed. It probably ended up taking the least ambitious route it could have taken. And so I was a little bit disappointed by that. But overall, I think her direction and Andrea Riseborough's performance just absolutely carry this film and shows. I mean, Andrea Riseborough has already shown, like, she's already kind of a built-in indie star. So she's already kind of shown what she can do. But I think it definitely shows promise for Stacey Gregs as well. Let me jump right into WeWork. And this is going to be a quick one since I was the only one who saw this one on today's discussion. WeWork attempts to deconstruct a central subject, but I think it could have benefited from a deeper look into the subject matter itself, like what the company actually does, to make it a little bit more of a comprehensive exploration of the events at hand. I think it does very well in kind of giving a whole look at the company's founder, Adam Neumann, because this is a company that I'm actually not quite sure what the company actually did. I think it's like meant to be a sort of real estate renting firm. But the thing here that I think this film does well is that it articulates how Adam Neumann, he is a master salesman. Like, I think he is a genius in that sense that he could sell anything to anyone. And he's kind of able to prop up this seemingly simple real estate company and turn it into kind of a global vision, something that plays on everyone, on a way to transform work, quote unquote. And I guess that's what the documentary is trying to do. If it does that, it is quite smart because it leaves you not quite knowing what the company actually is, which I guess if it's trying to put you in the perspective of the employees or of the bystanders, I think that would work quite well. But for a kind of an objective documentary like this, where I think objectivity is obviously key to telling the story, I don't think that approach worked that well, or at least it did not click for me, because I definitely would have appreciated a bit more context as to what exactly the company does. What are the divisions between corporate and the actual employees? Because I think they overlapped quite a bit. And I was left not knowing, okay, is this thread regarding the actual corporate structure of the film? Or is it thread regarding to its employees / customers? And that part left me a little bit confused. So I think they could have been a little bit clearer. Again, it works if they're trying to confuse the audience and put them in the shoes of the people experiencing that company in those days. But I think as an objective documentary, which is what it should be, it fails to fully kind of clarify what is truly going on. So anyways, now let's move on to Off-Season. Did any of you guys see that one?
I did.
Okay, yeah, so go ahead.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of this one. It was a movie that I saw at 3 a.m. in the morning. I finished it, and I was like, wow, that is one long feature-length video game cutscene. And yeah, the atmosphere is there, the plot, not so much, performances, not so much, and the direction, well, unfortunately, not so much. So that's my take on Off-Season.
Yeah, I was pretty mixed on this one as well. I also saw it quite late at night, and there are definitely some standout moments that I would disagree with the direction there, because there are definitely some standout moments there that like really had me gripped, such as kind of the end. I'm sure you know, like with the bridge closing and the red lights pulsing. But overall, I did find certain parts to be quite generic, and this script was absolutely not there. I think with a better script, this film could have definitely worked and become one of my favorites of the festival. But because of its, I think, affinity for just kind of like taking the cheap route out, it did not work for me. And again, I think I was a little bit disappointed with this one because I had heard so much about it. And overall, I think it was a little bit too redundant and unambitious for me to truly love. So anyways, why don't we move on to now Demi Lovato, Dancing with the Devil. Have any of you guys seen that
one? Oh, yeah.
Yes, I have. Allison, would you like to go first?
Oh, no, that's okay. You can go.
Okay. Yeah, Demi Lovato, Dancing with the Devil. I will start out by admitting that I don't follow her music. I don't let alone follow her personal life. So a lot of what happened to her and her backstory, how she came to be, I'm really out of it. That's just me with celebrities in general. I tend to not follow these things. So I found this documentary quite gripping and quite interesting to really, really learn how did she get to this point. What are some potential factors that drove her or have staggered her behavior or her career. And so it was terrifying, horrifying, tragic, but it's also empowering. I found the first half of this documentary to be very good, very, very good. The way they would interview her friends, her team, and then herself, and they recount the days of the night before her overdose or the day of, the morning of, with some bits of animation. I thought it was all really well handled, well told, and well directed too, in how it informs us of all this information and what everyone in her circle, how they were all feeling. I found this to be not just a story about Demi Lovato herself, but it's just as much about her friends, the people close to her and the people she cares about. I think what pulls it back from being a great documentary is a couple things. I found it structure-wise to be a bit repetitive, and I think it's because it's actually a four-part miniseries. It's not really a documentary film, so there's four segments to this. And I felt like a few of them covered the same thing, or at least I felt like in the interviews they said the same thing. It's almost as if each section has to sort of recount what they said and what happened just in case you didn't see the previous section. At least that's the impression I got from this format. And then the other thing that bothered me a little bit, just a little bit, is near the end, like in this four-part documentary, the final part, I get that it's supposed to be about how she's moving on and what she has learned from this entire process. But it's also told in a way of how she's channeling it towards her music and towards her work. And I could not stop thinking about how the final part is really about promoting her upcoming stuff. And the documentary started to not feel like a documentary anymore. It started to feel more like those kinds of quote unquote documentaries that singers would make of themselves to hype up their next album. And I personally didn't need that.
I also was not very familiar with Demi Lovato's music, just by name only. And so it was definitely an emotional roller coaster. I was crying throughout nearly the whole thing. It was horrible that she talks about being raped while she was working on Camp Rock, which was a Disney show. I think someone else, another girl who worked on that, who is now an adult, said something about abuse while working on that. She also talks about being abused by her drug dealer who left her for dead when she overdosed on July 24th, 2018. So the main thing that was missing for me is that she fails to disclose the name of these abusers. They could be, well, I don't know about the drug dealer, but the other guy could be a really powerful person. We do not know. But I think that she does reveal a lot of stuff that it was very empowering for her to do so. And I'm sure it took years for her to get to the place where she could actually admit some of this stuff. And she was very vulnerable by talking about how she started to try heroin, crack cocaine, and meth. And I think one of the saddest or most revealing parts of the documentary, or the most vulnerable part, is she wrote a song called Sober, and I'm not very familiar with the song, but she wrote Sober while she was relapsing. And, you know, just the incredible pressure that these young girls face when they're in the eye of the media. They have to be perfect. They have to look perfect. And she was talking about how she didn't feel like she could eat what she wanted to eat, and, you know, just feeling guilty over a cookie. And that was just incredibly sad, because all of that pressure probably led to the drug abuse. And it seems like she's doing well now. She's really balancing everything out. She's, you know, talking about how she only smokes weed from time to time and, you know, alcohol from here to there, which weed is legal in California. So it's really not that big of a deal. And it's natural as opposed to like the harder drugs. So it's just so sad that even though she revealed all this stuff, that there's still... her abusers are out there somewhere, as far as we know. So this even leaves room for maybe another episode or something in the future where she's able to reveal the names of these people. And with the Me Too movement, I know it made a lot of men nervous, the abusers anyway, because they knew that maybe their time was up. And hopefully this makes her abusers a little bit nervous, like, uh-oh, you know, they're possibly coming for me in the future, and rightly so. Another disturbing thing is that Scooter Braun became her new manager. So after her overdose, she definitely needed new management. And Scooter Braun handled some of the top names in the industry, but he totally screwed over Taylor Swift when he sold the rights to 6 of her albums without really even talking to her. And so now she is recording these albums. Because he got absolutely no input from her. So I think it's dangerous that he's in control of Demi's career right now, too. I mean, he could pull something like this later. So I'm sort of worried for Demi in the future, because it's like he better not do anything like that to her. So that's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, so in my opinion, I think Demi Lovato, Dancing with the Devil, I think it would have benefited definitely from a deeper exploration and a smoother structure, as Kevin was saying. Again, there were some parts that were redundant a little bit. Some parts that did feel like if they were more for promotion rather than like actually exploring what happened to her. Although I do think that maybe the first 3 episodes did feel like authentic explorations of her struggles. And I actually did not know much about the angle that Allison was mentioning. Like I'm not necessarily very deep into the music industry and Taylor Swift and Demi Lovato. Like, I know about them, but I wasn't like someone who would always be listening to their music. So that is interesting to hear that Scooter Braun is her new manager after this apparent history of maybe not treating his artists right. I definitely think that issues could arise from that. So it was a little bit strange, and I think it was jarring to most people to kind of see that in this documentary as kind of part of her recovery. But I do feel that I appreciated how this is a film or a documentary that kind of breaks the divide between, okay, like perfect celebrity and like flawed human. And Lovato definitely shows a lot of vulnerability, kind of revealing a side of her that the public has never seen before. And so I do have to appreciate that angle of it, that it takes a lot of bravery from her to kind of shed all those concepts or like what people thought about her, both positive and negative, and just kind of show her true self. So that was something that I really appreciated as well. But overall, I think it's definitely worth the watch if you're a fan of her. Even if you're, I think, someone who knows about celebrity culture, which is pretty much all of us, I do feel like it's worth a watch, at least the first 3 episodes, because it is interesting to see how people really are behind that facade. And they even talk about it, because this whole project started as just a general tour documentary. For the last time she was on tour, and she even straight up says, like, they use a lot of the footage, but she straight up says, that wasn't the real me. That was just a facade I was putting up for that documentary crew. And it's not until after her overdose that she decides to kind of just truly be herself and show who she actually is. So I appreciated that a lot. And so now we've kind of arrived to our last major discussion, which is that of The Fallout. Now, this one, I believe, won the grand jury prize. It got mostly positive reviews. I haven't seen much negative reception to it, but I'm extremely excited to hear what you guys all think about this one.
So I really love The Fallout, directed by Megan Park. I don't know if any of you saw Vox Lux, but it basically has the same exact opening where there's a tragedy at school. And I liked Vox Lux, but I was like thinking, I'm never going to watch this again because it's so disturbing. And I was disturbed all over again. I guess the difference between The Fallout and Vox Lux is they don't show the shooting in The Fallout, which is insane because you see the students barricading themselves, and it was so disturbing. Like, when I was growing up, we had the threat of school shootings for the most part. I mean, there was Columbine, but just to know that students live under the very real threat of school shootings these days, and it could happen to anyone. I thought the performance from the main character portrayed by Jenna Ortega was really good. She kind of gets obsessed or infatuated with like the hot girl at school played by Maddie Ziegler. And you see like the normal frustrations of a high school student compounded by the fact that like she knew people who died. And it was just this crazy emotional exploration of that, and just to see like the memorials, the flyers from the memorials. Just she has like a huge stack in her drawer, and just seeing that is just so disturbing. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I really like this movie as well. I'm glad you brought up Vox Lux, because I love that movie as well. But whereas Vox Lux is about how we as a country and as a culture tend to distract ourselves with pop culture and entertainment and not really truly think about the horrific things that happen. This one is really, I mean, there's a reason why it's called The Fallout. It really is just about how this one incident, these horrifying 6 minutes, can totally ruin people's lives. The ending to this movie is not only devastating, but it was also just, I hate to say it, it's like it's the only ending that this movie could have. And because it's so honest and raw and authentic with the subject matter, I really do have to give props to Megan Park for how she approached this material. And the performances, all the performances in this movie are fantastic, but especially Jenna Ortega, like, wow, like I cannot wait to see what she does next. There are some parts of the film that were conventional, like a conventional coming of age story, but they were still really poignant and really interesting because they're all put under this lens of them being survivors of this traumatic event. And so there is a unpredictability and devastation where you're wondering exactly what decisions these characters will be making. And I found that to be very suspenseful and heartbreaking. I really loved the protagonist. Her relationship with her younger sister was just, I think that was a highlight for me personally, because I have a younger sister and she's younger than me by 8 years. And so I really resonated with that specific relationship out of many, because there were many relationships in this movie, and I found all of them to be terrifically made. The one minor thing I thought about was there's a minor performance here by Shailene Woodley, which I thought she was great, but I felt like she wasn't in the movie enough, and I felt like the movie could have benefited from either having her more or not having her at all. Either of those, I think, would improve the structure and pacing of the movie just a bit better. But that's a really, really minor thing. I understand why this movie won Grand Jury, and I think it really does deserve that win. I think everybody should see this.
And I'll guess I'll go last. I have a bit of a hot take on this. I think Megan Park's screenplay is extraordinarily empathetic, real and raw. And as somebody who is a teenager, pretty much just 1 year over, I'm in my first year of college, so like I just basically experienced high school. It's great to see actually a movie that sort of represents high schoolers almost bang on to at least what happened in my school, even though I'm in Canada and this takes place in the United States. There's a lot of similarities in that. So it is a very realist film in some regards. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. And I also really enjoyed how this film wasn't exploitative of the specific tragedy that happens in the opening act, nor does it actually exploit its characters in emotionally pandering drama or anything of that sort. I think my main issue is primarily with the blocking and the direction of the film that this film took. I think the blocking specifically is almost reminiscent of a Disney Channel original movie, and I really hate to say it, but it kind of really pains me because it also does feel almost sort of unnatural and saturated at moments where like very personal dialogues needed to have more time to truly flourish and to actually emphasize on this theme of tragedy and a unifying factor between these three primary characters who are kind of bonding over this sort of one major event. And at least for me, I wish there was more time to develop some of the dialogues. I wish there was a little bit more emphasis on sort of the trauma aspect of it all, but I think it is a very well-intentioned feature. I just personally wasn't all that big on it, but I could definitely see why this won the Grand Jury Prize, because out of all the competition films I've seen, this one actually feels like there is a great idea in here. And I think that if Megan Park has a bigger budget in the future, and maybe even a bigger production company backing up her films, I think she can create more earnest pieces of art in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely loved how emotional and raw the fallout was. I think what this film does best is kind of portray those kind of interpersonal, small interpersonal relationships that many films wouldn't necessarily focus on. And again, like, we even had Mass last year, which kind of focuses more on the aftermath, or maybe the people who aren't necessarily at the heart of the tragedy, but just know people or like had people involved in this tragedy. But in this film, you actually get to explore people who were there witnessing the tragedy as it happened. And I mean, I went into this film not knowing much, actually, apart from just seeing that first still of Jenna Ortega and Maddie Ziegler just lounging in a pool. And so I was actually quite shocked by the beginning. But I think I know what you're mentioning, David, and I think that they actually did that on purpose, and it works in the context of the film, because when you go in with kind of that more kind of standard blocking, maybe not necessarily trying too many visual tricks, in my mind, I was like, okay, this is probably going to be some like fun high school movie, right? And then with that same framing of, as you were calling, a Disney Channel original, I think it's a little bit more artistic than that. So I'd have to disagree there, but I get the concept that you're trying to reach at. And by framing it like that, the first thing your mind goes to is, okay, this is going to be a standard high school movie, right? And then the shooting actually happens, and that juxtaposed with the pretty standard framing of a generic high school movie, I think it really made sure like that moment was very powerful for me. How, let's say, like, Jenna Ortega's character kind of just admires Maddie Ziegler's character from afar, and then because of this tragedy, they're forced to bond in a way that they weren't expecting. And throughout the rest of the film, you see that they're kind of alienated from everyone else apart. Also, I think Quentin also, I'd say I put him in that because he was at least there at some points. But I think that those three characters feel alienated from the rest of the people at school. And I don't know if it's because they shared that moment with such an isolation, and that maybe there weren't any teachers or anyone who kind of knew exactly what to do around, and they had to kind of face that conflict themselves all alone, and maybe that resulted in that bond. But it was, I think, incredible to see that. The one thing I would say is that how it kind of portrays, I think it's Nick, but Jenna Ortega's best friend at the beginning of the film ends up becoming this huge like activist for like taking away gun rights. And I think that what this film does is that it kind of treats him badly, and it's like, oh, that's just fame changing him, where it's no, that he's trying to make a change. And I think this film would have worked a little bit better in that regard if it had kind of made the point that, okay, everyone has their different way of coping. Like, I feel that they were a little bit too harsh on him, because if you look at it from his point of view, like, yeah, what he's doing is amazing. Like, he's super focused on making sure that this event never happens again, or at least tries to make sure it never happens again. And the film kind of just, since it's framed through Jenna Ortega's character perspective, I think it's Veda is her name, that it kind of disregards him a little bit too much and calls him cruel in certain parts. So I think that character could have been treated with a little bit more respect, because what he's doing is very commendable. But overall, it was so raw. It was so emotional. I think this was the one that hit me the hardest, because, again, this art house horror genre is totally my jam. But I think from a purely dramatic standpoint, it's clear that The Fallout is leagues above anything else. And the ending as well, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's unexpected, but it's the fact that it's not unexpected, and that when it came out, I was like, oh yeah, like Kevin was saying, that when it came out, I was like, oh yeah, that, like, I was expecting that, just says a lot about the American high school system and how much needs to change. Because the fact that she had that emotional response, and again, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a spoiler, but the thing is, something that has happened previously in the film happens again, and she has this we see she's starting to have this emotional reaction to it as it pans up, right? I took it as like, oh wow, like that is something that just, it happens repeatedly. And I think it results in this emotional stunting where you kind of get used to hearing news like that. Like, that was the reaction that I had. Like, I was like, oh, this is just something that happens. And the fact that like I'm built to think that way, and I'm sure you guys are all built to think that way as well, just really shows how how much needs to change in our society today. Well, that's it for this week's episode of the Global Film Podcast. Where can we find everyone on social media?
I'm on Twitter at AlliCinema, A-L-L-I Cinema.
You can find me at K-L-E-E underscore film review.
You can find me on Twitter, Letterboxd, and even Instagram at TICKTOCKANIMATE, TikTok, Animate.
And you can find me personally at The Diego Andaluz on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd, as well as the podcast at Global Film Pod on Twitter, as well as all podcasting platforms. Thank you, everyone, for coming on board. Thank you all for listening. And make sure to rate, subscribe, and follow us to be notified when the next episode comes out.